I woke myself up with such a god-awful jerk that I almost fell out of bed myself. It was early morning with the first sun laying across the floor in a stripe. Vera was still sleeping. She drooled all over my arm. But at first I didn't have the strength to wipe it off. I just laid there, trembling, all covered with sweat, trying to make myself believe I was really awake and things was really all right. The way you do, you know, after a really bad nightmare. And for a second there, I could still see that dust head with its big, empty eyes and long, dusty teeth laying on the floor beside the bed. That's how bad the dream was. Then it was gone. The floor and the corners of the room were as clean and empty as always. But I've always wondered since then if maybe she didn't send me that dream. If I didn't see a little of what she saw those times when she screamed. Maybe I picked up a little of her fear and made it my own. You think things like that ever happen in real life? Or only in those cheap newspapers they sell down to the grocery? I don't know. But I know that dream scared the bejesus out of me. Well, never mind. Suffice it to say that screaming her friggin' head off on Sunday afternoons and in the middle of the night was the third way she had of being a bitch. But it was a sad, sad thing all the same. All her bitchiness was sad at the bottom, although that didn't stop me from sometimes wanting to spin her head around like a spool on a spindle. And I think anybody but Saint Joan of friggin' art would have felt the same. I guess when Susie and Shauna heard me yelling that day that I'd like to kill her, or when other people heard me, or heard us yelling mean things at each other, well, they must have thought I'd hike up my skirts and tap dance on her grave when she finally give over. And I imagine you've heard from some of them yesterday and today, haven't you, Andy? No need to answer. All the answer I need's right there on your face. It's a regular billboard. Besides, I know how people love to talk. They talked about me and Vera, and there was a country fair amount of globber about me and Joe, too. Some before he died and even more after. Out here in the boondocks, about the most interesting thing a person can do is die sudden. Did you ever notice that? So here we are at Joe. I've been dreading this part, and I guess there's no use lying about it. I already told you I killed him, so that's over with. But the hard part is still all ahead. How and why, and when it had to be. I've been thinking about Joe a lot today, Andy. More about him than about Vera, truth to tell. I kept trying to remember just why I married him in the first place, for one thing. And at first I couldn't do it. After a while I got into a kind of panic about it, like Vera when she'd get the idea there was a snake inside her pillow slip. Then I realized what the trouble was. I was looking for the love part. Like I was one of those foolish little girls Vera used to hire in June and then fire before the summer was halfway done because they couldn't keep to her rules. I was looking for the love part, and there was precious little of that even back in 1945, when I was 18 and he was 19 and the world was new. You know, the only thing that come to me while I was out there on the steps today, freezing my tuchus off and trying to remember about the love part? He had a nice forehead. I sat near him in study hall back when we was in high school together, during World War II, that was, and I remember his forehead, how smooth it looked, without a single pimple on it. There was some on his cheeks and chin, and he was prone to blackheads on the sides of his nose, but his forehead looked as smooth as cream. I remember wanting to touch it, dreaming about touching it, to tell the truth, wanting to see if it was as smooth as it looked. And when he asked me to the junior-senior prom, I said yes, and I got my chance to touch his forehead. And it was every bit as smooth as it looked, with his hair going back from it in these nice smooth waves, me stroking his hair and his smooth forehead in the dark while the band inside the ballroom of the Samoset Inn played Moonlight Cocktail. After a few hours of sitting on those damn rickety steps and shivering, that came back to me at least. So you see, there was a little something there after all. Of course, I found myself touching a lot more than just his forehead before too many more weeks had passed, and that was where I made my mistake. Now let's get one thing straight. I ain't trying to say I ended up spending the best years of my life with that old rumpot just because I liked the look of his forehead in Period 7 study hall when the light came slanting in on it. Shit, no. But I am trying to tell you that's all the love part I was able to remember today. And that makes me feel bad. Sitting out on the stairs today by the east head, thinking over those old times. That was damned hard work. It was the first time I saw that I might have sold myself cheap. And maybe I did it because I thought cheap was the best the likes of me could expect to get for herself. I know it was the first time I dared to think that I deserved to be loved more'n Joe St. George could love anybody, except himself, maybe. You mightn't think a hard-talking old bitch like me believes in love, but the truth is, it's just about the only thing I do believe in. It didn't have much to do with why I married him, though. I gotta tell you that straight out. I had 6 weeks' worth of baby girl in my belly when I told him I didn't, I would, until death do us part. And that was the smartest part of it, sad but true. The rest of it was all the usual stupid reasons. And one thing I've learned in my life is that stupid reasons make stupid marriages. I was tired of fighting with my mother. I was tired of being scolded by my father. All my friends was doing it. They was getting homes of their own, and I wanted to be a grown-up like them. I was tired of being a silly little girl. He said he wanted me, and I believed him. He said he loved me, and I believed that, too. And after he'd said it and asked me if I felt the same for him, it only seemed polite to say I did. I was scared of what would happen to me if I didn't, where I'd have to go, what I'd have to do, who'd look after my baby while I was doing it. All that's going to look pretty silly if you ever write it up, Nancy. But the silliest thing is I know a dozen women who were girls I went to school with who got married for those same reasons. And most of them are still married, and a good many of them are only holding on, hoping to outlive the old man so they can bury him and then shake his beer farts out of the sheets forever. By 1952 or so, I'd pretty well forgotten his forehead. And by 1956, I didn't have much use for the rest of him either. And I guess I'd started hating him by the time Kennedy took over from Ike. But I never had a thought of killing him till later. I thought I'd stay with him because my kids needed a father, if for no other reason. Ain't that a laugh? But it's the truth, I swear it is. And I swear something else as well. If God gave me a second chance, I'd kill him again. Even if it meant hellfire and damnation forever. Which it probably does. I guess everybody on Little Tall who ain't a Johnny-come-lately knows I killed him. And most of them probably think they know why, because of the way he had of using his hands on me. But it wasn't his hands on me that brought him to grief. And the simple truth is that no matter what people on the island might have thought at the time, he never hit me a single lick during the last 3 years of our marriage. I cured him of that foolishness in late 1960 or early 61. Up until then, he hit me quite a lot, yes. I can't deny it. And I stood for it. I can't deny that either. The first time was the second night of the marriage. We'd gone down to Boston for the weekend. That was our honeymoon. And stayed at the Parker House. Hardly went out the whole time. We was just a couple of country mice, you know, and afraid we'd get lost. Joe said he was damned if he was going to spend the $25 my folks had given us for mad money on a taxi ride just because he couldn't find his way back to the hotel. Gory, what, that man dumb. Well, of course I was, too. But one thing Joe had that I didn't, and I'm glad of it, too, was that everlasting suspicious nature of his. He had the idea the whole human race was out to do him dirty, Joe did. And I thought plenty of times that when he did get drunk, maybe it was because it was the only way he could go to sleep without leaving one eye open. Well, that ain't neither here nor there. What I set out to tell you was that we went down to the dining room that Saturday night, had a good dinner, and then went back up to our room again. Joe was listening considerably to starboard on the walk down the hall, I remember. He'd had 4 or 5 beers with his dinner and another 9 or 10 over the course of the afternoon. Once we were inside the room, he stood there looking at me so long, I asked him if he saw anything green. No, he says, but I seen a man down there in that restaurant looking up your dress, Dolores. His eyes were just about hanging out on springs, and you knew he was looking, didn't you? I almost told him Gary Cooper could have been sitting in the corner with Rita Hayworth, and I wouldn't have known it. And then thought, why bother? It didn't do any good to argue with Joe when he'd been drinking. I didn't go into that marriage with my eyes entirely shut, and I'm not going to try to kid you that I did. If there was a man looking up my dress, why didn't you go over and tell him to shut his eyes, Joe? I asked. It was only a joke. Maybe I was trying to turn him aside. I really don't remember. But he didn't take it as a joke. That I do remember. Joe wasn't a man to take a joke. In fact, I'd have to say he had almost no sense of humor at all. That was something I didn't know going into it with him. I thought back then that a sense of humor was like a nose or a pair of ears. That some worked better than others, but everybody had one. He grabbed me and turned me over his knee and paddled me with his shoe. For the rest of your life, nobody's going to have any idea what color underwear you got on but me, Dolores, he said. You hear that? Nobody but me. I actually thought it was a kind of love play, him pretending to be jealous, to flatter me. That's what a little ninny I was. It was jealousy, all right, but love had nothing to do with it. It was more like the way a dog will put a paw over his bone and growl if you come too near it. I didn't know that then, so I put up with it. Later on, I put up with it because I thought a man hitting his wife from time to time was only another part of being married. Not a nice part, but then cleaning toilets ain't a nice part of being married either. But most women have done their fair share of it after the bridal dress and veil have been packed away in the attic. Ain't they, Nancy? My own dad used his hands on my mum from time to time. And I suppose that was where I got the idea that it was all right. Just something to be put up with. I loved my dad dearly, and him and her loved each other dearly. But he could be a handsy kind of man when he had a hair laying just right across his ass. I remember one time, I must have been, I'm going to say 9 years old, when Dad came in from haying George Richard's field over on the West End, and Mum didn't have his dinner on. I can't remember any more why she didn't, but I remember real well what happened when he came in. He was wearing only his bibs. He'd taken his work boots and socks off out on the stoop because they were full of chaff. And his face and shoulders was burned bright red. His hair was sweated against his temples, and there was a piece of hay stuck to his forehead right in the middle of the lines that waved across his brow. He looked hot and tired and ready to be pissed off. He went into the kitchen, and there wasn't nothing on the table but a glass pitcher with flowers in it. He turns to Mum and says, "Where's my supper, dummy?" She opened her mouth, but before she could say anything, he put his hand over her face and pushed her down in the corner. I was standing in the kitchen entry and seen it all. He come walking toward me with his head lowered and his hair kind of hanging in his eyes. Whenever I see a man walking home that way, tired out from his day of work and his dinner bucket in his hand, it makes me think of my dad. And I was some scared. I wanted to get out of his way because I felt he would push me down too. But my legs was too heavy to move. He never, though. He just took hold of me with his big, warm, hard hands and set me aside and went out back. He sat down on the chopping block with his hands in his lap and his head hung down like he was looking at them. He scared the chickens away at first, but they come back after a while and started pecking all around his shoes. I thought he'd kick out at them, make the feathers fly, but he never done that either. After a while, I looked around at my mum. She was still sitting in the corner. She'd put a dish towel over her face and was crying underneath it. Her arms were crossed over her bosom. That's what I remember best of all, though I don't know why, how her arms were crossed over her bosom like that. I went over and hugged her, and she felt her arms around my middle and hugged me back. Then she took the dish towel off her face and used it to wipe her eyes and told me to go out back and ask Daddy if he wanted a glass of cold lemonade or a bottle of beer. "Be sure to tell him there's only 2 bottles of beer," she said. "If he wants more than that, he'd better go to the store or not get started at all." I went out and told him, and he said he didn't want no beer, but a glass of lemonade would hit the spot. I ran to fetch it. Mum was getting his supper. Her face was still kind of swole from crying, but she was humming a tune. And that night they bounced the bedsprings just like they did most nights. Nothing else was ever said or made of it. That sort of thing was called home correction in those days. It was part of a man's job. And if I thought of it afterward at all, I only thought that my mum must have needed some, or Dad never would have done what he did. There was a few other times I saw him correct her, but that's the one I remember best. I never saw him hit her with his fist, like Joe sometimes hit me. But once he stropped her across the legs with a piece of wet canvas sailcloth, and that must have hurt like a bastard. I know it left red marks that didn't go away all afternoon. No one calls it home correction anymore. The term has passed right out of conversation, so far as I can tell, and good riddance. But I grew up with the idea that when women and children step off the straight and narrow, it's a man's job to herd them back onto it. I ain't trying to tell you that just because I grew up with the idea, I thought it was right, though. I won't let myself slip off that easy. I knew that a man using his hands on a woman didn't have much to do with correction. But I let Joe go on doing it to me for a long time just the same. I guess I was just too tired from keeping house, cleaning for the summer people, raising my family, and trying to clean up Joe's messes with the neighbors to think much about it. Being married to Joe, oh, shit, what's any marriage like? I guess they are all different ways, but there ain't one of them that's what it looks like from the outside, I can tell you that. What people see of a married life and what actually goes on inside it are usually not much more than kissing cousins. Sometimes that's awful, and sometimes it's funny. But usually it's like all the other parts of life, both things at the same time. What people think is that Joe was an alcoholic who used to beat me, and probably the kids too, when he was drunk. They think he finally did it once too often and I punched his ticket for it. It's true that Joe drank, and that he sometimes went to the AA meetings over in Jonesport, but he was no more an alcoholic than I am. He'd throw a drunk every 4 or 5 months, mostly with trash like Jerry Thibodeau or Stevie Brooks. Those men really were alcoholics. But then he'd leave it alone except for a nip or two when he came in at night. No more than that, because when he had a bottle, he liked to make it last. The real alkies I've known in my time, none of them was interested in making a bottle of anything last. Not Jim Beam or Old Duke, not even DeRail, which is antifreeze strained through cotton batten. A real drunk is only interested in two things, putting paid to the jug in the hand and hunting for the one still in the bush. No, he wasn't an alcoholic, but he didn't mind if people thought he'd been one. It helped him get work, especially in the summer. I guess the way people think about Alcoholics Anonymous has changed over the years. I know they talk about it a lot more than they used to. But one thing that hasn't changed is the way people will try to help somebody who claims he's already gone to work helping himself. Joe spent one whole year not drinking, or at least not talking about it when he did. And they had a party for him over in Jonesport. Gave him a cake and a medallion, they did. So when he went for a job one of the summer people needed done, the first thing he'd tell him was that he was a recovering alcoholic. If you don't want to hire me because of that, I won't have any hard feelings, he'd say. But I have to get it off my chest. I've been going to AA meetings for over a year now, and they tell us we can't stay sober if we can't be honest. And then he'd pull out his gold one-year medallion and show it to him, all the while looking like he hadn't had nothing to eat but humble pie for a month of Sundays. I guess one or two of them just about cried when Joe told him about how he was working it a day at a time and taking it easy and letting go and letting God whenever the urge for a drink hit him, which it did about every 15 minutes, according to him. They'd usually fall all over themselves taking him on, and at 50 cents or even a dollar an hour more than they'd intended to pay, like as not. You'd have thought the gimmick would have fallen flat after Labor Day, but it worked amazing well even here on the island, where people saw him every day and should have known better. The truth is, most of the times Joe hit me, he was cold sober. When he had his skin full, he didn't much mind me at all, one way or the other. Then in 60 or 61, he come in one night after helping Charlie Dispensieri get his boat out of the water. And when he bent over to get a Coke out of the fridge, I seen his britches were split right up the back. I laughed. I couldn't help myself. He didn't say nothing. But when I went over to the stove to check on the cabbage, I was making a boiled dinner that night, I remember like it was yesterday. He got a chunk of rock maple out of the wood box and whacked me in the small of the back with it. Oh, that hurt. You know what I mean if anyone's ever hit you in the kidneys? It makes them feel small and hot and so heavy, like they're going to bust loose from whatever holds them where they're supposed to be, and they'll just sink, like lead shot in a bucket. I hobbled as far as the table and sat in one of the chairs. I would have fallen on the floor if that chair had been any further away. I just sat there, waiting to see if the pain was going to pass. I didn't cry exactly because I didn't want to scare the kids, but the tears went rolling down my face just the same. I couldn't stop them. They were tears of pain, the kind you can't hold back for anybody or anything. "Don't you ever laugh at me, you bitch," Joe says. He slung the stove length he hit me with back into the wood box and sat down to read the American. "You ought to have known better than that 10 years ago." It was 20 minutes before I could get out of that chair. I had to call Selina to turn down the heat under the veg and the meat, even though the stove wasn't but 4 steps away from where I was sitting. "Why didn't you do it, Mommy?" she asked me. "I was watching cartoons with Joey." "I'm resting," I told her. "That's right," Joe says from behind his paper. "She ran her mouth until she got all tuckered out." And he laughed. That did it. That one laugh was all it took. I decided right then he wasn't never going to hit me again unless he wanted to pay a dear price for it. We had supper just like usual and watched the TV just like usual afterward, me and the big kids on the sofa and little Pete on his father's lap in the big easy chair. Pete dozed off there, same as he almost always did, around 7:30, and Joe carried him to bed. I sent Joan Jr. an hour later, and Selina went at 9. I usually turned in around 10, and Joe'd sit up until maybe midnight, dozing in and out, watching a little TV, reading parts of the paper he'd missed the first time, and picking his nose. So you see, Frank, you're not so bad. Some people never lose the habit, even when they grow up. That night, I didn't go to bed when I usually did. I sat up with Joe instead. My back felt a little better. Good enough to do what I had to do, anyway. Maybe I was nervous about it, but if I was, I don't recall. I was mostly waiting for him to doze off, and finally he did. I got up, went into the kitchen, and got the little cream pitcher off the table. I didn't go out looking for that special. It was only there because it was Joe Jr.'s night to clean off the table, and he'd forgotten to put it in the refrigerator. Joe Jr. always forgot something. To put away the cream pitcher, to put the glass top on the butter dish, to fold the bread wrapper under so the first slice wouldn't get all hard overnight. And now when I see him on the TV news, making a speech or giving an interview, that's what I'm most apt to think about. I wonder what the Democrats would think if they knew the majority leader of the Maine State Senate couldn't never manage to get the kitchen table completely cleared off when he was 11. I'm proud of him, though, and don't you ever, ever think any different. I'm proud of him, even if he is a goddamn Democrat. Anyway, he sure managed to forget the right thing that night. It was little, but it was heavy, and it felt just right in my hand. I went over to the wood box, and I got the short-handled hatchet we kept on the shelf just above it. Then I walked back into the living room where he was dozing. I had the pitcher cupped in my right hand, and I just brought it down and around and smacked it against the side of his face. It broke into about 1,000 pieces. He sat up pretty pert when I done that, Andy. And you should have heard him. Loud, Father God and Sonny Jesus. Sounded like a bull with his pizzle caught in the garden gate. His eyes come wide open and he clapped his hand to his ear, which was already bleeding. There was little dots of clotted cream on his cheek and then that scraggle down the side of his face he called a sideburn. "Guess what, Joe," I says. "I ain't feeling tired anymore." I heard Selina jump out of bed, but I didn't dare look around. I could have been in hot water if I'd done that. When he wanted to, he could be sneaky fast. I'd been holding the hatchet in my left hand down to my side with my apron almost covering it. And when Joe started to get up out of his chair, I brought it out and showed it to him. If you don't want this in your head, Joe, you better sit down again, I said. For a second, I thought he was going to get up anyway. If he had, that would have been the end of him right then, because I wasn't kidding. He seen it, too, and froze with his butt about 5 inches off the seat. Mommy? Selena called from the doorway of her room. You go on back to bed, honey, I says, not taking my eyes off Joe for a single second. Your father and I are having a little discussion here. Is everything all right? Yeah, I says. Isn't it, Joe? Uh-huh, he says, right as rain. I heard her take a few steps back, but I didn't hear the door of her room close for a little while. 10, maybe 15 seconds. And I knew she was standing there and looking at us. Joe stayed just like he was, with one hand on the arm of his chair and his butt hiked up off of the seat. Then we heard her door close, and that seemed to make Joe realize how foolish he must look, half in his seat and half out of it, with his other hand clapped over his ear and little clots of cream dribbling down the side of his face. He sat all the way down and took his hand away. Both it and his ear were full of blood, but his hand wasn't swelling up and his ear was. Oh, bitch, ain't you gonna get a payback, he says. Am I? I told him. Well, then you better remember this, Joe St. George. What you pay out to me, you are gonna get back double. He was grinning at me like he couldn't believe what he was hearing. Why, I guess I'll just have to kill you then, won't I? I handed over the hatchet to him almost before the words were out of his mouth. It hadn't been in my mind to do it, but as soon as I seen him holding it, I knew it was the only thing I could have done. Go on, I says. Just make the first one count so's I don't have to suffer. He looked from me to the hatchet and then back to me again. The look of surprise on his face would have been comical if the business hadn't been so serious. Then once it's done, you better heat up that boiled dinner and help yourself to some more of it, I told him. Eat till you bust, because you'll be going to jail, and I ain't heard they serve anything good and home-cooked in jail. You'll be over in Belfast to start with, I guess. I bet they got one of those orange suits just your size. Shut up, you cunt, he says. I wouldn't, though. After that, you'll most likely be in Shawshank. And I know they don't bring your meals hot to the table there. They don't let you out Friday nights to play poker with your beer joint buddies either. All I ask is that you do it quick, and don't let the kids see the mess once it's over. Then I closed my eyes. I was pretty sure he wouldn't do it. But being pretty sure don't squeeze much water when it's your life on the line. That's one thing I found out that night. I stood there with my eyes shut, seeing nothing but dark, and wondering what it'd feel like having that hatchet come carving through my nose and lips and teeth. I remember thinking I'd most likely taste the wood splinters on the blade before I died, and I remember being glad I'd had it on the grindstone only 2 or 3 days before. If he was going to kill me, I didn't want it to be with a dull hatchet. Seemed like I stood there like that for about 10 years. Then he said, kind of gruff and pissed off, "Are you going to get ready for bed or just stand there like Helen Keller having a wet dream?" I opened my eyes and saw he'd put the hatchet under his chair. I could just see the end of the handle sticking out from under the flounce. His newspaper was laying on top of his feet in a kind of tent. He bent over, picked it up, and shook it out, trying to behave like it hadn't happened, none of it. But there was blood pouring down his cheek from his ear, and his hands were trembling just enough to make the pages of the paper rattle a tiny bit. He'd left his fingerprints in red on the front and back pages, too, and I made up my mind to burn the damn thing before he went to bed so the kids wouldn't see it and wonder what happened. I'll be getting into my nightgown soon enough, but we're going to have an understanding on this first, Joe. He looks up and says, all tight-lipped, "You don't want to get too fresh, Dolores. That'd be a bad, bad mistake. You don't want to tease me." "I ain't teasing," I says. "Your days of hitting me are over, that's all I want to say. If you ever do it again, one of us is going to the hospital or to the morgue." He looked at me for a long, long time, Andy, and I looked back at him. The hatchet was out of his hand and under the chair, but that didn't matter. I knew that if I dropped my eyes before he did, the punches in the neck and the hits in the back wouldn't never end. But at long last, he looked down at his newspaper again and kind of muttered, "Make yourself useful, woman. Bring me a towel for my head if you can't do nothing else. I'm bleeding all over my goddamn shirt." That was the last time he ever hit me. He was a coward at heart, you see, although I never said the word out loud to him, not then and not ever. Doing that's about the most dangerous thing a person can do, I think, because a coward is more afraid of being discovered than he is of anything else, even dying. Of course, I knew he had a yellow streak in him. I never would have dared hit him upside the face with that cream pitcher in the first place if I hadn't felt I had a pretty good chance of coming out on top. Besides, I realized something as I sat in that chair after he hit me, waiting for my kidneys to stop aching. If I didn't stand up to him then, I probably wouldn't ever stand up to him. So I did. You know, taking the cream pitcher to Joe was really the easy part. Before I could do it, I had to once and for all rise above the memory of my dad pushing my mum down, and of him stropping the backs of her legs with that length of wet sailcloth. Getting over those memories was hard, because I dearly loved them both. But in the end, I was able to do it, probably because I had to do it. And I'm thankful I did, if only because Selina ain't never gonna have to remember her mother sitting in the corner and bawling with a dish towel over her face. My mum took it when her husband dished it up, but I ain't gonna sit in judgment of either of them. Maybe she had to take it, and maybe he had to dish it up or be belittled by the men he had to live and work with every day. Times were different back then. Most people don't realize how different. But that didn't mean I had to take it from Joe just because I'd been enough of a goose to marry him in the first place. There ain't no home correction in a man beating a woman with his fists or a stove length out of the wood box. And in the end, I decided I wasn't going to take it from the likes of Joe St. George or from the likes of any man. So he never hit me again. There were times when he raised a hand to do it, but then he'd think better of it. Sometimes when the hand was up, wanting to hit but not quite daring to hit, I'd see in his eyes that he was remembering the cream pitcher. Maybe the hatchet, too. And then he'd make like he only raised that hand because his head needed scratching or his forehead wiping. That was one lesson he got the first time, maybe the only one. There was something else come out of the night he hit me with a stove length and I hit him with a cream pitcher. I don't like to bring it up. I'm one of those old-fashioned folks that believes what goes on behind the bedroom door should stay there, but I guess I better, because it's probably part of why things turned out as they did. Although we were married and living under the same roof together for the next 2 years, and it might have been closer to three, I really can't remember, he only tried to take his privilege with me a few times after that. He... What, Andy? Of course I mean he was impotent. What else would I be talking about? His right to wear my underwear if the urge took him? I never denied him. He just quit being able to do it. He wasn't what you'd call an every-night sort of man, not even back at the start. And he wasn't one to draw it out, either. He was always pretty much wham-bam and thank you, ma'am. If I hadn't been a quick-heating sort of woman, I never would have gotten no pleasure out of it at all. Still and all, he'd stayed interested enough to climb on top once or twice a week, until I hit him with the creamer, that is. Part of it was probably the booze. He was drinking a lot more during those last years. But I don't think that was all of it. No sir and no ma'am. I remember him rolling off of me one night after about 20 minutes of useless puffing and blowing, and his little thing still just hanging there, limp as a noodle. I don't know how long after the night I just told you about this would have been, but I know it was after, because I remember laying there with my kidneys throbbing and thinking I'd get up pretty soon and take some aspirin to quiet them down. "There," he says, almost crying. "I hope you're satisfied, Dolores. Are you?" I didn't say nothing. Sometimes anything a woman says to a man is bound to be the wrong thing. "Are you?" he says. "Are you satisfied, Dolores?" I didn't say nothing still. Just laid there and looked up at the ceiling and listened to the wind outside. It was from the east that night, and I could hear the ocean in it, That's a sound I've always loved. It soothes me. He turned over, and I could smell his beer breath on my face, rank and sour. Turning out the light used to help, he says, but it don't no more. I can see your ugly face even in the dark. He reached out, grabbed my boob, and kind of shook it. And this, he says, all floppy and flat as a pancake. Your cunt's even worse. Christ, you ain't 35 yet and fucking use like fucking a mud puddle. I thought of saying if it was a mud puddle, you could stick it in soft, Joe. And wouldn't that relieve your mind? But I kept my mouth shut. Dolores Claiborne's mother didn't raise any fools, like I told you. There was some more quiet. I'd about decided he'd said enough mean things to finally send him off to sleep, and I was thinking about slipping out to get my aspirin when he spoke up again. And that time, I'm pretty sure he was crying. I wish I'd never seen your face, he says. And then he says, why didn't you just use that friggin' hatchet to whack it off, Dolores? It would have come to the same. So, you see, I wasn't the only one that thought getting hit with the cream pitcher and being told things was going to change around the house might have had something to do with his problem. I still didn't say nothing, though. Just waited to see if he was going to go to sleep or try to use his hands on me again. He was laying there naked, and I knew the very first place I was going to go for if he did try. Pretty soon I heard him snoring. I don't know if that was the very last time he tried to be a man with me, but if it wasn't, it was close. None of his friends got so much as a whiff of these goings-on, of course. He sure as hell wasn't going to tell him his wife had whopped the bejesus out of him with a creamer and his weasel wouldn't stick up its head anymore, was he? Not him. So when the others had talked big about how they was handling their wives, he talked big right along with them. Saying how he laid one on me for getting fresh with my mouth, or maybe for buying a dress over in Jonesport, without asking him first if it was all right to take money out of the cookie jar. How do I know? Why, because there are times when I can keep my ears open instead of my mouth. I know that's hard to believe, listening to me tonight, but it's true. I remember one time when I was working for the Marshalls. Remember Frank Marshall, Andy? How he was always talking about building a bridge over to the mainland? And the doorbell rang. I was all alone in the house, and I was hurrying to answer the door, and I slipped on a throw rug and fell hard against the corner of the mantel. It left a great big bruise on my arm, just above the elbow. About 3 days later, just when that bruise was going from dark brown to a kind of yellow-green like they do, I ran into Yvette Anderson in the village. She was coming out of the grocery, and I was going in. She looked at the bruise on my arm, and when she spoke to me, her voice was just dripping with sympathy. Only a woman who's just seen something that makes her happier than a pig in shit can drip that way. Ain't men awful, Dolores, she says. Well, sometimes they are and sometimes they aren't, I says back. I didn't have the slightest idea what she was talking about. What I was mostly concerned with was getting some of the pork chops that were on special that day before they were all gone. She pats me kind of gentle on the arm, the one that wasn't bruised, and says, "You be strong now. All things work for the best. I've been through it, and I know. I'll pray for you, Dolores." She said that last like she'd just told me she was going to give me $1,000,000, and then went on her way up street. I went into the market, still mystified. I would have thought she'd lost her mind, except anyone who's ever passed the time of day with Yvette knows she ain't got a whole hell of a lot to lose. I had my shopping half done when it hit me. I stood there watching Skippy Porter weigh my chops, my market basket over my arm and my head thrown back, laughing from way down deep inside my belly, the way you do when you know you can't do nothing but let her rip. Skippy looked round at me and says, "You all right, Mrs. Claiborne?" "I'm fine," I says. "I just thought of something funny." And off I went again. "I guess you did," Skippy says. And then he went back to his scales. God bless the porters, Andy. As long as they stay, there'll be at least one family on the island knows how to mind its business. Meantime, I just went on laughing. A few other people looked at me like I'd gone nuts, but I didn't care. Sometimes life is so goddamn funny you just have to laugh. Yvette's married to Tommy Anderson, of course. And Tommy was one of Joe's beer and poker buddies in the late 50s and early 60s. There'd been a bunch of them out at our place a day or two after I bruised my arm, trying to get Joe's latest bargain, an old Ford pick-em-up, running. It was my day off, and I brought them all out a pitcher of iced tea, mostly in hopes of keeping them off the suds at least till the sun went down. Tommy must have seen the bruise when I was pouring the tea. Maybe he asked Joe what happened after I left, or maybe he just remarked on it. Either way, Joe St. George wasn't a fella to let opportunity pass him by, not one like that, at least. Thinking it over on my way home from the market, the only thing I was curious about was what Joe told Tommy and the others I'd done. Forgot to put his bedroom slippers under the stove so they'd be warm when he stepped into them, maybe? Or cooked the beans too mushy on Saturday night? Whatever it was, Tommy went home and told Yvette that Joe St. George had needed to give his wife a little home correction. And all I'd ever done was bang off the corner of the Marshall's mantelpiece, running to see who was at the door. That's what I mean when I say there's two sides to a marriage, the outside and the inside. People on the island saw me and Joe like they saw most other couples our age. Not too happy, not too sad. Mostly just going along like two horses pulling a wagon. They may not notice each other like they once did, and they may not get along with each other as well as they once did when they do notice each other. But they're harnessed side by side and going down the road as well as they can just the same, not biting each other or lollygagging and doing any of the other things that draw the whip. But people aren't horses. Marriage ain't much like pulling a wagon, even though I know it sometimes looks that way on the outside. The folks on the island didn't know about the cream pitcher, or how Joe cried in the dark and said he wished he'd never seen my ugly face. Nor was that the worst of it. The worst didn't start until a year or so after we finished our doings in bed. It's funny, ain't it, how folks can look right at a thing and draw a completely wrong conclusion about why it happened. But it's natural enough, as long as you remember that the inside and outside of a marriage aren't usually much alike. What I'm going to tell you now was on the inside of ours, and until today I always thought it would stay there. Looking back, I think the trouble must have really started in 62. Selena'd just started high school over on the mainland. She had come on real pretty, and I remember that summer after her freshman year, she got along with her dad better than she had for the last couple of years. I'd been dreading her teenage years, foreseeing a lot of squabbles between the two of them as she grew up and started questioning his ideas and what he saw as his rights over her more and more. Instead, there was that little time of peace and quiet and good feelings between them when she'd go out and watch him work on his old clunkers behind the house or sit beside him on the couch while we were watching TV at night. Little Pete didn't think much of that arrangement, I can tell you. And ask him questions about his day during the commercials. He'd answer her in a calm, thoughtful way I wasn't used to. But I sort of remembered. From high school, I remembered it. Back when I was first getting to know him, and he was deciding that, yes, he wanted to court me. At the same time this was happening, she drew a distance away from me. Oh, she'd still do the chores I set her, and sometimes she'd talk about her day at school, but only if I went to work and pulled it out of her. There was a coldness that hadn't been there before, and it was only later on that I began to see how everything fit together. And how it all went back to the night she'd come out of her bedroom and seen us there, her dad with his hand clapped to his ear and blood running through the fingers, her mom standing over him with a hatchet. He was never a man to let certain kinds of opportunity pass him by, I told you, and this was just more of the same. He'd told Tommy Anderson one kind of story. The one he told his daughter was in a different pew but the same church. I don't think there was anything in his mind at first but spite. He knew how much I loved Selena, and he must have thought telling her how mean and bad-tempered I was, maybe even how dangerous I was, would be a fine piece of revenge. He tried to turn her against me, and while he never really succeeded at that, he did manage to get closer to her than he'd been since she was a little girl. Why not? She was always tender-hearted, Selena was, and I never ran up against a man as good at the poor me's as Joe was. He got inside her life, and once he was in there, he must have finally noticed just how pretty she was getting, and decided he wanted something more from her than just to have her listen when he talked, or hand him the next tool when he was head down in the engine compartment of some old junk truck. And all the time this was going on and the changes were happening, I was running around working about 4 different jobs and trying to stay far enough ahead of the bills to sock away a little each week for the kids' college educations. I never saw a thing until it was almost too late. She was a lively, chatty girl, my Selina, and she was always eager to please. When you wanted her to fetch something, she didn't walk, she went on the run. As she got older, she'd put supper on the table when I was working out, and I never had to ask her. She burned some at first and Joe'd carp at her or make fun of her. He sent her crying into her room more than once. But he quit doing that around the time I'm telling you about. Back then, in the spring and summer of 1962, he acted like every pie she made was pure ambrosia, even if the crust was like cement. And he'd rave over her meatloaf like it was French cuisine. She was happy with his praise. Of course she was. Anyone would have been. But she didn't get all puffed up with it. She wasn't that kind of girl. Tell you one thing, though. When Selina finally left home, she was a better cook on her worst day than I ever was on my best. When it came to helping out around the house, a mother never had a better daughter, especially a mother who had to spend most of her time cleaning up other people's messes. Selina never forgot to make sure Joe Jr. and little Pete had their school lunches when they went out the door in the morning, and she covered their books for them at the start of every year. Joe Jr. at least could have done that chore for himself, but she never gave him the chance. She was an honor roll student her freshman year, but she never lost interest in what was going on around her at home, the way some smart kids do at that age. Most kids of 13 or 14 decide anyone over 30 is an old fogey, and they're apt to be out the door about 2 minutes after the fogies come through it. Not Selina, though. She'd get 'em coffee or help with the dishes or whatever, then sit down in the chair by the Franklin stove and listen to the grown-ups talk. Whether it was me with one or two of my friends or Joe with 3 or 4 of his, she'd listen. She would have stayed even when he and his friends played poker if I'd let her. I wouldn't, though, because they talked so foul. That child nibbled conversation the way a mouse'll nibble a cheese rind, and what she couldn't eat, she stored away. Then she changed. I don't know just when that change started, but I first saw it not too long after she started her sophomore year, towards the end of September, I'm going to say. The first thing I noticed was that she wasn't coming home on the early ferry like she had at the end of most school days the year before. Although that had worked out real well for her, she was able to get her homework finished in her room before the boys showed up, then do a little cleaning or start supper. Instead of the 2 o'clock, she was taking the one that leaves the mainland at 4:45. When I asked her about it, she said she just decided she liked doing her homework in the study hall after school, that was all, and gave me a funny little sidelong look that said she didn't want to talk about it anymore. I thought I saw shame in that look, and maybe a lie as well. Those things worried me, but I made up my mind I wasn't going to push on with it no further unless I found out for sure something was wrong. Talking to her was hard, you see. I'd felt the distance that had come between us, and I had a pretty good idea what it all traced back to. Joe sitting in his chair, bleeding, and me standing over him with the hatchet. And for the first time, I realized that he'd probably been talking to her about that and other things, putting his own spin on him, so to speak. I thought if I chaffed Selina too hard on why she was staying late at school, my trouble with her might get worse. Every way I thought of asking her more questions came out sounding like, "What have you been up to, Selina?" And if it sounded that way to me, a 35-year-old woman, how was it going to sound to a girl not quite 15? It's so hard to talk to kids when they're that age. You have to walk around them on tiptoe, the way you would a jar of nitroglycerin sitting on the floor. Well, they have a thing called Parents' Day not long after school lets in, and I took special pains to get to it. I didn't do as much pussyfooting around with Selena's homeroom teacher as I had with Selena herself. I just stepped right up and asked her if she knew any particular reason why Selena was staying for the late ferry this year. The homeroom teacher said she didn't know, but she guessed it was just so Selena could get her homework done. Well, I thought, but didn't say, she was getting her homework done just fine at the little desk in her room last year, so what's changed? I might have said it if I thought that teacher had any answers for me, but it was pretty clear she didn't. Hell, she was probably scat gone herself the minute the last bell of the day rung. None of the other teachers were any help either. I listened to them praise Selena to the skies, which weren't hard work for me to do at all, and then I went back home again feeling no further ahead than I'd been on my way over from the island. I got a window seat inside the cabin of the ferry and watched a boy and girl not much older than Selena standing outside by the rail holding hands and watching the moon rise over the ocean. He turned to her and said something that made her laugh up at him. "You're a fool if you miss a chance like that, sonny boy," I thought. But he didn't miss it. Just leaned toward her, took her other hand, and kissed her as nice as you please. "Gorry, ain't you foolish," I said to myself as I watched him. "Either that or too old to remember what it's like to be 15, with every nerve in your body blasting off like a Roman candle all of the day and most of the night. Selena's met a boy, that's all. She's met a boy, and they're probably doing their studies together in that room after school, studying each other more in their books, most likely." I was some relieved, I can tell you. I thought about it over the next few days. One thing about washing sheets and ironing shirts and vacuuming rugs, you always have lots of time to think. And the more I thought, the less relieved I was. She hadn't been talking about any boy, for one thing, and it wasn't ever Selena's way to be quiet about what was going on in her life. She wasn't as open and friendly with me as she'd been before. No. But it wasn't like there was a wall of silence between us either. Besides, I'd always thought that if Selena fell in love, she'd probably take out an ad in the paper. The big thing, the scary thing, was the way her eyes looked to me. I've always noticed that when a girl's crazy about some boy, her eyes are apt to get so bright it's like someone turned on a flashlight behind there. When I looked for that light in Selena's eyes, it wasn't there. But that wasn't the bad part. The light that had been there before had gone out of them, too. That was the bad part. Looking into her eyes was like looking at the windows of a house where the people have left without remembering to pull down the shades. Seeing that was what finally opened my eyes, and I began to notice all sorts of things I should have seen earlier. Would have seen earlier, I think, if I hadn't been working so hard, and if I hadn't been so convinced Selena was mad at me for hurting her dad that time. The first thing I saw was that it wasn't just me anymore. She'd drawn away from Joe, too. She'd stopped going out to talk to him when he was working on one of his old junks or somebody's outboard motor, and she'd quit sitting beside him on the couch at night to watch TV. If she stayed in the living room, she'd sit in the rocker, way over by the stove with a piece of knitting in her lap. Most nights, she didn't stay, though. She'd go in her room and shut the door. Joe didn't seem to mind or even to notice. He just went back to his easy chair, holding little Pete on his lap until it was time for Pete to go to bed. Her hair was another thing. She didn't wash it every day like she used to. Sometimes it looked almost greasy enough to fry eggs in. And that wasn't like Selena. Her complexion was always so pretty. That nice peaches and cream skin she probably got from Joe's side of the family tree. But that October, pimples sprang up on her face like dandelions on the town common after Memorial Day. Her color was off, and her appetite, too. She still went to see her two best friends, Tanya Karen and Laurie Langle, once in a while, but not anywhere near as much as she had in junior high. That made me realize neither Tanya or Laurie had been over to our house since school let back in, and maybe not during the last month of the summer vacation, neither. That scared me, Andy, and it made me lean in for an even closer look at my good girl. What I saw scared me even more. The way she'd changed her clothes, for instance. Not just one sweater for another, or a skirt for a dress. She'd changed her whole style of dressing, and all the changes were bad. You couldn't see her shape any more, for one thing. Instead of wearing skirts or dresses to school, she was mostly wearing A-line jumpers, and they was all too big for her. They made her look fat, and she wasn't. At home, she'd wear big baggy sweaters that came halfway to her knees, and I never saw her out of her jeans and work boots. She'd put some ugly rag of a scarf around her head whenever she went out, something so big it'd overhang her brow and make her eyes look like two animals peering out of a cave. She looked like a tomboy, but I thought she'd put paid to that when she said so long to 12. And one night, when I forgot to knock on her door before I went into her room, she just about broke her legs getting her robe off of the closet door. And she was wearing a slip. It wasn't like she was bollocky bare-ass or nothing. But the worst thing was that she didn't talk much any more. Not just to me. Considering the terms we were on, I could have understood that. She pretty much quit talking to everybody, though. She'd sit at the supper table with her head down, and the long bangs she'd grown hanging in her eyes. And when I tried to make conversation with her, ask her how her day had gone at school and things like that, all I'd get back was, "Okay," and "Guess so," instead of the blue streak she used to talk. Joe Jr. tried, too, and run up against the same stone wall. Once or twice he looked at me, kind of puzzled. I just shrugged. And as soon as the meal was over and the dishes was washed, out the door or up to her room she'd go. And, God help me, the first thing I thought of after I decided it wasn't a boy was marijuana. And don't you give me that look, Andy, like I don't know what I'm talking about. It was called reefer, or Mary Jane instead of pot in those days, but it was the same stuff, and there was plenty of people from the island willing to move it around if the price of lobsters went down, or even if it didn't. A lot of reefer came in through the coastal islands back then, just like it does now, and some of it stayed. There was no cocaine, which was a blessing. But if you wanted to smoke pot, you could always find some. Marky Benoit had been arrested by the Coast Guard just that summer. They found 4 bales of the stuff in the hold of the Maggie's Delight. Probably that's what put the idea in my head. But even now, after all these years, I wonder how I ever managed to make something so complicated out of what was really so simple. There was the real problem, sitting right across the table from me every night, usually needing a bath and a shave. And there I was, looking right back at him. Joe St. George, little Tall Island's biggest jack of all trades and master of none, and wondering if my good girl was maybe out behind the high school wood shop in the afternoon smoking joysticks. And I'm the one who likes to say her mother didn't raise no fools. Gory. I started thinking about going into her room and looking through her closet and bureau drawers, but I didn't do much of that before I got disgusted with myself. I may be a lot of things, Andy, but I hope I ain't never been a sneak. Still, even having the idea made me see that I'd spent way too much time just creeping around the edges of whatever was going on, hoping the problem would solve itself or that Selena would come to me on her own. There came a day, not long before Halloween, because little Pete had put up a paper witch in the entry window, I remember, when I was supposed to go down to the Strayhorn place after lunch. Me and Lisa McCandless were going to turn those fancy Persian rugs downstairs. You're supposed to do that every 6 months so they won't fade, or so they'll fade even, or some damn thing. I put my coat on and got it buttoned and was halfway to the door when I thought, "What are you doing with this heavy fall coat on, you foolish thing? It's 65 degrees out there, at least. Real Indian summer weather." And this other voice come back and said, "It won't be 65 out on the reach, though. It'll be more like 50 out there. Damp, too." And that's how I come to know I wasn't going anywhere near the Strayhorn place that afternoon. I was going to take the ferry across to Jonesport instead and have it out with my daughter. I called Lisa, Told her we'd have to do the rugs another day, and left for the ferry landing. I was just in time to catch the 2:15. If I'd missed it, I might have missed her. And who knows how different things might have turned out then. I was the first one off the ferry. They was still slipping the last mooring rope over the last post when I stepped down onto the dock, and I went straight to the high school. I got the idea on my way up that I wasn't going to find her in the study hall, no matter what she and her homeroom teacher said, that she'd be out behind the woodshop after all with the rest of the thuds, all of them laughing and grab-assing around and maybe passing a bottle of cheap wine in a paper bag. If you ain't never been in a situation like that, you don't know what it's like, and I can't describe it to you. All I can say is that I was finding out that there's no way you can prepare yourself for a broken heart. You just have to keep marching forward and hope like hell it doesn't happen. But when I opened the study hall door and peeked in, she was there, sitting at a desk by the windows with her head bent over her geometry book. She didn't see me at first, and I just stood there looking at her. She hadn't fallen in with bad company like I'd feared, but my heart broke a little just the same, Andy, because it looked like she'd fallen in with no company at all, and could be that's even worse. Maybe her homeroom teacher didn't see anything wrong with a girl studying all by herself after school in that great big room. Maybe she even thought it was admirable. I didn't see nothing admirable about it, though, nor anything healthy either. She didn't even have the detention kids to keep her company, because they keep the bad actors in the library at Jonesport Beals High. She should have been with her girlfriends, maybe listening to records or mooning over some boy, and instead she was sitting there in a dusty ray of afternoon sun, sitting in the smell of chalk and floor varnish and that nasty red sawdust they put down after all the kids had gone home, sitting with her head bent so close over her book that you'd have thought all the secrets of life and death was in there. "Hello, Selina," I says. She cringed like a rabbit and knocked half her books off her desk, turning round to see who'd told her hello. Her eyes were so big they looked like they filled the whole top half of her face, and what I could see of her cheeks and forehead was as pale as buttermilk in a white cup. Except for the places where the new pimples were, that is, they stood out a bright red like burn marks. Then she saw it was me. The terror went away, but no smile come in its place. It was like a shutter dropped over her face, or like she was inside a castle and had just drawn up the moat. Yes, like that. You see what I'm trying to say? "Mama," she says, "what are you doing here?" I thought of saying, "I've come to take you home on the ferry and get some answers out of you, my little sweetheart." But something told me it would have been wrong in that room, that empty room where I could smell the thing that was wrong with her just as clear as I could smell the chalk and the red sawdust. I could smell it, and I meant to find out what it was. From the look of her, I'd waited far too long already. I didn't think it was dope any more, but whatever it was hungry. It was eating her alive. I told her I'd decided to toss my afternoon's work out the door and come over and window shop a little, but I couldn't find anything I liked. "So I thought maybe you and I could ride back on the ferry together," I said. "Do you mind, Selina?" She finally smiled. I would have paid $1,000 for that smile, I can tell you. A smile that was just for me. "Oh, no, Mommy," she said. "It would be nice having company." So we walked back down the hill to the ferry landing together. And when I asked her about some of her classes, she told me more than she had in weeks. After that first look she gave me, like a cornered rabbit looking at a tomcat, she seemed more like her old self than she had in months, and I began to hope. Well, Nancy here may not know how empty that 4:45 to Little Tall in the Outer Islands is, but I guess you and Frank do, Andy. Most of the working folk who live off the mainland go home on the 5:30, and what comes on the 4:45 is mostly parcel, post, UPS, shop goods, and groceries bound for the market. So even though it was a lovely autumn afternoon, nowhere near as cold and damp as I thought it was going to be, we had the aft deck, mostly to ourselves. We stood there a while, watching the wake spread back toward the mainland. The sun was on the wester by then, beating a track across the water, and the wake broke it up and made it look like pieces of gold. When I was a little girl, my dad used to tell me it was gold, and that sometimes the mermaids came up and got it. He said they used those broken pieces of late afternoon sunlight as shingles on their magic castles under the sea. When I saw that kind of broken golden track on the water, I always watched it for mermaids, and until I was almost Selena's age, I never doubted there were such things, because my dad had told me there were. The water that day was the deep, silky shade of blue you only seem to see on calm days in October, and the sound of the diesels was soothing. Selena untied the kerchief she was wearing over her head and raised her arms and laughed. "Isn't it beautiful, Mom?" she asked me. "Yes," I said, "it is. And you used to be beautiful too, Selena. Why ain't you anymore?" She looked at me, and it was like she had two faces on. The top one was puzzled and still kind of laughing, but underneath there was a careful, distrusting sort of look. What I saw in that underneath face was everything Joe had told her that spring and summer, before she had begun to pull away from him, too. "I don't have no friends," is what that underneath face said to me. "Certainly not you, nor him either." And the longer we looked at each other, the more that face came to the top. She stopped laughing and turned away from me to look out over the water. That made me feel bad, Andy, but I couldn't let it stop me any more than I could let Vera get away with her bitchery later on, no matter how sad it all was at the bottom. The fact is, sometimes we do have to be cruel to be kind. Like a doctor giving a shot to a child, even though he knows the child will cry and not understand. I looked inside myself and saw I could be cruel like that if I had to. It scared me to know that then, and it still scares me a little. It's scary to know you can be as hard as you need to be, and never hesitate before or look back afterward and question what you did. Remember when I said that love can be like a tiger's claw? "I don't know what you mean, Mom," she says, but she was looking at me with a careful eye. "You've changed," I said. "Your looks, the way you dress, the way you act, all those things tell me you're in some kind of trouble." "There's nothing wrong," she said, but all the time she was saying it, she was backing away from me. I grabbed her hands in mine before she could get too far away to reach. "Yes, there is," I said, "and neither of us is stepping off this ferry until you tell me what it is." "Nothing," she yelled. She tried to yank her hands free, but I wouldn't let loose. "Nothing's wrong. Now let go. Let me go." "Not yet," I says. "Whatever trouble you're in won't change my love for you, Selena, but I can't begin helping you out of it until you tell me what it is." She stopped struggling then and only looked at me. And I seen a third face below the first two, a crafty, miserable face I didn't like much. Except for her complexion, Selena usually takes after my side of the family. But right then, she looked like Joe. "Tell me something first," she says. "I will if I can," I says back. "Why'd you hit him?" she asks. "Why'd you hit him that time?" I open my mouth to ask what time, mostly to get a few seconds to think. But all at once I knew something, Andy. Don't ask me how. It might have been a hunch, or what they call woman's intuition, or maybe I actually reached out somehow and read my daughter's mind, but I did. I knew that if I hesitated even for a second, I was going to lose her. Maybe only for that day, but all too lightly for good. It was a thing I just knew, and I didn't hesitate a beat. "Because he hit me in the back with a piece of stove wood earlier that evening," I said. "Just about crushed my kidneys. I guess I just decided I wasn't going to be done that way any more. Not ever again." She blinked the way you do when somebody makes a quick move toward your face with their hand, and her mouth dropped open in a big surprised O. "That ain't what he told you it was about, was it?" She shook her head. "What'd he say? his drinking. That and his poker games, she said, in a voice almost too low to hear. He said you didn't want him or anybody else to have any fun. That was why you didn't want him to play poker, and why you wouldn't let me go to Tanya's sleepover last year. He said you want everyone to work 8 days a week like you do, and when he stood up to you, you conked him with the creamer, and then said you'd cut off his head if he tried to do anything about it, that you'd do it while he was sleeping. I would have laughed, Andy, if it hadn't been so awful. Did you believe him? I don't know, she said. Thinking about that hatchet made me so scared I didn't know what to believe. That went in my heart like a knife blade, but I never showed it. Selina, I says, what he told you was a lie. Just leave me alone, she said, pulling back from me. That cornered rabbit look come on her face again, and I realized she wasn't just hiding something because she was ashamed or worried. She was scared to death. I'll fix it myself. I don't want your help, so just leave me alone. You can't fix it yourself, Selina, I says. I was using the low, soothing tone you'd use on a horse or lamb that's gotten caught in a barbed wire fence. If you could have, you already would have. Now listen to me. I'm sorry you had to see me with that hatchet in my hand. I'm sorry about everything you saw and heard that night. If I'd known it was going to make you so scared and unhappy, I wouldn't have took after him, no matter how much he provoked me. Can't you just stop it? She asks. And then she finally pulled her hands out of mine and put them over her ears. I don't want to hear any more. I won't hear any more. I can't stop because that's over and done with, beyond reach, I says, but this ain't. So let me help, dear heart, please. I try to put an arm around her and draw her to me. Don't you hit me. Don't you even touch me, you bitch. She screams and shoved herself backwards. She stumbled against the rail, and I was sure she was going to go flip-flop right over it and into the drink. My heart stopped, but thank God my hands never did. I reached out, caught her by the front of the coat, and drug her back toward me. I slipped in some wet and almost fell. I caught my balance, though, and when I looked up, she hauled off and slapped me across the side of the face. I never minded, just grabbed hold of her again and hugged her against me. You quit at a time like that with a child Selina's age. I think a lot of what you had with that child is going to be over for good. Besides, that slap didn't hurt a bit. I was just scared of losing her. And not just from my heart, neither. For that 1 second, I was sure she was going to go over the rail with her head down and her feet up. I was so sure I could see it. It's a wonder all my hair didn't go gray right then. Then she was crying and telling me she was sorry, that she never meant to hit me, that she never, ever meant to do that, and I told her I knew it. Hush a while, I says. And what she said back almost froze me solid. You should have let me go over, Mommy, she said. You should have let me go. I held her out from me at arm's length. By then we was both crying, and I says, nothing could make me do a thing like that, sweetheart. She was shaking her head back and forth. I can't stand it any more, Mommy. I can't. I feel so dirty and confused, and I can't be happy no matter how hard I try. What is it? I says, beginning to be frightened all over again. What is it, Selina? If I tell you, she says, you'll probably push me over the rail yourself. You know better, I says, and I'll tell you another thing, dear heart. You ain't stepping foot back on dry land until you've come clean with me. If going back and forth on this ferry for the rest of the year is what it takes, then that's what we'll do. Although I think we'll both be frozen solid before the end of November, if we ain't died of ptomaine from what they serve in that shitty little snack bar. I thought that might make her laugh, but it didn't. Instead, she bowed her head so she was looking at the deck and said something real low. With the sound of the wind and the engines, I couldn't quite hear what it was. What did you say, sweetheart? She said it again, and I heard it that second time, even though she didn't speak much louder. All at once, I understood everything, and Joe St. George's days were numbered from that moment on. I never wanted to do anything. He made me. That's what she said. For a minute, I could only stand there, and when I finally did reach for her, she flinched away. Her face was as white as a sheet. Then the fairy, the old island princess that was, took a lurch. The world had already gone slippery on me, and I guess I would have gone on my skinny old ass if Selina hadn't grabbed me around the middle. The next second it was me holding her, and she crying against my neck. I blessed each tear as it fell. "Come on," I says. "Come on over here and sit down with me. We've had enough ramming from one side of this boat to the other to last us a while, haven't we?" We went over to the bench by the aft companionway with our arms around each other, shuffling like a pair of invalids. I don't know if Selina felt like an invalid or not, but I sure did. I was only leaking from the eyes a little, but Selina was crying so hard it sounded like she'd pull her guts loose from their moorings if she didn't quit pretty soon. I was glad to hear her cry that way, though. It wasn't until I heard her sobbing and seen the tears rolling down her cheeks that I realized how much of her feelings had gone away, too, like the light in her eyes and the shape inside her clothes. I would have liked hearing her laugh one frig of a lot better than I liked hearing her cry, but I was willing to take what I could get. We sat down on the bench, and I let her cry a while longer. When it finally started to ease off a little, I gave her the hanky from my purse. She didn't even use it at first. She just looked at me, her cheeks all wet and deep brown hollows under her eyes, and she says, "You don't hate me, Mommy? You really don't?" "No," I says. "Not now, not never. I promise on my heart. But I want to get this straight. I want you to tell me the whole thing, all the way through. I see on your face that you don't think you can do that, but I know you can. And remember this. You'll never have to tell it again, not even to your own husband if you don't want to. It will be like drawing a splinter. I promise that on my heart, too. Do you understand?" "Yes, Mommy. But he said, if I ever told..." "Sometimes you get so mad," he said. "Like the night you hit him with the cream pot. He said, if I ever felt like telling, I'd better remember the hatchet. And..." "No, that's not the way," I says. "You need to start at the beginning and go right through her. But I want to be sure I got one thing straight from the word go. Your dad's been at you, hasn't he?" She just hung her head and didn't say nothing. It was all the answer I needed. But I think she needed to hear herself saying it right out loud. I put my finger under her chin and lifted her head until we were looking each other right in the eye. "Hasn't he?" "Yes," she said, and broke out sobbing again. This time it didn't last so long nor go so deep, though. I let her go on a while, though, because it took me a while to see how I should go on. I couldn't ask what's he done to you, because I thought the chances were pretty good she wouldn't know for sure. For a little while, the only thing I could think of was, has he fucked you? But I thought she might not know for sure, even if I put it just that way, that crude. And the sound of it was so damned ugly in my head. At last I said, "Has he had his penis into you, Selina? Has he had it in your pussy?" She shook her head. "I haven't let him," she swallowed back a sob. "Not yet, anyway." Well, we were both able to relax a little after that, with each other, anyway. What I felt inside was pure rage. It was like I had an eye inside, one I never knew about before that day, and all I could see with it was Joe's long, horsey face, with his lips always cracked and his big teeth always kind of yellow and his cheeks always chapped and red high up on the cheekbones. I saw his face pretty near all the time after that. That eye wouldn't close, even when my other two did and I was asleep, and I began to know it wouldn't close until he was dead. It was like being in love, only inside out. Meantime, Selina was telling her story from beginning to end. I listened and didn't interrupt even once. And, of course, it started with the night I hit Joe with the creamer, and Selina come to the door in time to see him with his hand over his bleeding ear and me holding the hatchet over him, like I really did intend to cut his head off with it. All I wanted to do was make him stop, Andy, and I risked my life to do it. But she didn't see none of that. Everything she saw stacked up on his side of the ledger. The road to hell's paved with good intentions, they say, and I know it's true. I know it from bitter experience. What I don't know is why. Why it is that trying to do good so often leads to ill. That's for wider heads than mine, I guess. I ain't going to tell that whole story here, not out of respect to Selina, but because it's too long and it hurts too much even now. But I'll tell you the first thing she said. I'll never forget it. Because I was struck again by what a difference there is between how things look and how they really are, between the outside and the inside. "He looked so sad sitting there in his chair," she said. "There was blood running between his fingers and tears in his eyes, and he just looked so sad. I hated you more for that look than for the blood and tears, Mommy, and I made up my mind to make it up to him. Before I went to bed, I got down on my knees and prayed. 'God,' I said, 'if you keep her from hurting him any more, I'll make it up to him. I swear I will, for Jesus' sake, amen.' You got any idea how I felt, hearing that from my daughter a year or more after I thought the door was shut on that business? Do you, Andy? Frank? What about you, Nancy Bannister from Kennebunk? No, I see you don't. I pray to God you never will." She started being nice to him, bringing him special treats when he was out in the back shed working on somebody's snowmobile or outboard motor, sitting beside him while we were watching TV at night, sitting with him on the porch step while he whittled, listening while he talked all his usual line of Joe St. George bullshit politics, how Kennedy was letting the Jews and Catholics run everything, how it was the commies trying to get the niggers into the schools and lunchrooms down south, and pretty soon the country would be ruined. She listened, she smiled at his jokes, she put corn huskers on his hands when they chapped, and he wasn't too deaf to hear opportunity knocking. He quit giving her the lowdown on politics in favor of giving her the lowdown on me, how crazy I could be when I was riled, and everything that was wrong with our marriage. According to him, it was mostly me. It was in the late spring of 1962 that he started touching her in a way that was a little more than just fatherly. That was all it was at first, though. Little strokes along the leg while they were sitting on the couch together and I was out of the room. Little pats on the bottom when she brought him his beer out in the shed. That's where it started, and it went on from there. By the middle of July, poor Selina'd gotten as scared of him as she already was of me. By the time I finally took it into my head to go across to the mainland and get some answers out of her, he'd done just about everything a man can do to a woman short of fucking her, and frightened her into doing any number of things to him as well. I think he would have had her cherry before Labor Day if it hadn't been for Joe Jr. and little Pete being out of school and underfoot a lot of the time. Little Pete was just there and in the way, but I think Joe Jr. had more'n half an idea of what was up and set out to put himself in the way of it. God bless him if he did, is all I can say. I was certainly no help, working 12 and sometimes 14 hours a day like I was back then. And all the time I was gone, Joe was around her, touching her, asking her for kisses, asking her to touch him in his special places. That's what he called him, and telling her that he couldn't help it. He had to ask. She was nice to him, I wasn't. A man had certain needs, and that was all there was to it. But she couldn't tell. If she did, he said, I might kill both of them. He kept reminding her about the creamer and the hatchet. He kept telling her about what a cold, bad-tempered bitch I was, and about how he couldn't help it because a man had certain needs. He drilled those things into her, Andy, until she was half crazy with them. He... What, Frank? Yes, he worked all right. But his kind of work didn't slow him down much when it came to chasing his daughter. A jack of all trades, I called him, and that's just what he was. He did chores for any number of the summer people and caretook two houses. I hope the people who hired him to do that kept a good inventory of their possessions. There were four or five different fishermen who'd call him to crew when they were busy. Joe was skinny but strong, and he could haul traps with the best of them if he weren't too hung over. And of course he had his small engines for a sideline. In other words, he worked the way a lot of island men work, although not as hard as most. A drib here and a drab there. A man like that can pretty much set his own hours, and that summer and early fall, Joe set his so's to be around the house as much as he could when I was gone, to be around Selina. Do you understand what I need you to understand, I wonder? Do you see that he was working as hard to get into her mind as he was to get into her pants? I think it was seeing me with that goddamn hatchet in my hand that had the most power over her. So that was what he used the most. When he saw he couldn't use it any more to gain her sympathy, he used it to scare her with. He told her over and over again that I'd drive her out of the house if I ever found out what they was doing. What they was doing? Gory. She said she didn't want to do it, and he said that was just too bad, but it was too late to stop. He told her she'd teased him until he was half crazy, and said that kind of teasing's why most rapes happen. And good women, meaning bad-tempered, hatchet-waving bitches like me, I guess, knew it. Joe kept telling her he'd keep his end quiet as long as she kept hers quiet. But, he told her, you have to understand, baby, that if some comes out, all comes out. She didn't know what he meant by all. And she didn't understand how bringing him a glass of iced tea in the afternoon and telling him about Laurie Langle's new puppy had given him the idea that he could reach between her legs and squeeze her there whenever he wanted. But she was convinced she must have done something to make him act so bad, and it made her ashamed. That was the worst of it, I think. Not the fear, but the shame. She said she set out one day to tell the whole story to Mrs. Sheets, the guidance counselor. She even made an appointment, but she lost her nerve in the outside office when another girl's appointment ran a little overtime. That had been less than a month before, just after school let back in. I started to think how it would sound, she told me as we sat there on the bench by the aft companionway. We were halfway across the reach by then, and we could see the east head, all lit up with the afternoon sun. Selina was finally done her crying. She'd give out a big watery sniffle every now and then, and my hanky was wet clear through. But she mostly had herself under control, and I was damn proud of her. She never let go of my hand, though. She held it in a death grip all the time we was talking. I had bruises on it the next day. I thought about how it'd be to sit down and say, "Mrs. Sheets, my dad is trying to do you-know-what to me." And she's so dense and so old, she'd probably say, "No, I don't know what, Selina. What are you talking about?" Only she'd say, "Talking about," like she does when she gets up on a high horse. And then I'd have to tell her that my own father was trying to screw me, and she wouldn't believe me, because people don't do things like that where she comes from. "I think it happens all over the world," I said. "Sad, but true. And I think a school guidance counselor would know it, too. Unless she's an out-and-out fool." "Is Mrs. Sheets an out-and-out fool, Selina?" "No," Selina says. "I don't think so, Mommy, but..." "Sweetheart, did you think you were the first girl this ever happened to?" I asks. And she said something again I couldn't hear on account of she talked so low. I had to ask her to say it again. "I didn't know if I was or not," she says, and hugs me. I hugged her back. "Anyway," she went on at last, "I found out sitting there that I couldn't say it. Maybe if I'd been able to march right in, I could have gotten it out. But not once I had time to sit and turn it over in my mind and to wonder if Daddy was right and you'd think I was a bad girl." "I'd never think that," I says, and give her another hug. She gave me a smile back that warmed my heart. "I know that now," she said. But then I wasn't so sure. And while I was sitting there, watching through the glass while Mrs. Sheets finished up with the girl that was before me, I thought up a good reason not to go in. "Oh," I asked her, "what was that?" "Well," she says, "it wasn't school business." That struck me funny, and I started to giggle. Pretty soon, Selina was giggling with me, and the giggles kept getting louder until we were sitting there on that bench, holding hands and laughing like a couple of loons in mating season. We were so loud that the man who sells snacks and cigarettes down below poked his head up for a second or two to make sure we were all right.